So today, the retreat continues to get better and better. So yesterday, you learned that you're, maybe not all of you, but most of you, are six slaves with big loans imprisoned in the desert. And today, I'm going to tell you that you're six slaves with big loans imprisoned in the desert about to die. So it's looking dire, isn't it? Or is it? So I don't know if things can get much worse, but we'll try and make them better. So today I wanted to talk about mindfulness of death and dying and perhaps even helping others in that process. And traditionally in Buddhism, when we talk about mindfulness, we usually refer to the four satipatthanas. That's the kind of foundational practices of establishing our mindfulness or directing our mindfulness to areas of existence where we assume that there is a sense of self, that there is a self dwelling in those places. So those kind of mindfulness meditations are basically directed to the body, to the feelings, usually arising in the body, but it can also be mental feelings, to the contents of the mind, and also to the states of mind. So these are the main kinds of meditation that we've been doing so far. When you observe your breath, that's a kind of mindfulness of the body. The breath is part of the body. When you observe the feelings in your body or your emotions, that's mindfulness of feelings. When you observe the state of your mind, how peaceful it is or how agitated it is, that's mindfulness of the mind. And the contents, the thoughts, the hindrances that arise is mindfulness of the mental contents. But as well as this, if this is not already helping you to overcome the five hindrances, there are four other kinds of meditation which are called the protective meditations, the four rakitas. And mindfulness of death is one of those. The others are loving kindness, which you've also been doing already. Contemplating the qualities of the Buddha, which we've also been doing. It's amazing. We've covered a lot, huh? Really? I didn't realize we've been doing all of it. And another one is looking at the unattractive nature of the body. Somebody hinted towards that, actually, in a question recently about overcoming lustful thoughts, craving, sensuality. And classically, the Buddha taught a little bit of body contemplation, looking at the unattractive nature of the body, the things that are going to kind of turn you away from having lustful thoughts, or just bring your mind to some sort of balance. So death contemplation is a very powerful one of these four protective meditations. And they're protective because they help us overcome the hindrances. They protect the mind from greed, hate, and delusion, especially the delusion that we all seem to love, which is that we're not going to die. Somehow we can defy the laws of nature and live on forever, which is a very deep-seated delusion in our mind. You know, we think of death as something that happens to other people at other times, not now, later, but it never happens to us, right? We don't want to think about it. We don't want to get close to that. So it helps us cultivate the mind and it helps us to move towards these peaceful states of mind by overcoming some of the delusion that we have and the kind of complacency and lack of heedfulness that can arise when we think we've got all the time in the world. So one of the most important things about death contemplation is that it can arouse a sense of spiritual urgency. And I use that phrase carefully because sometimes we might think that that means we have to try harder. But no, we have to let go of trying even more. Right? So we actually learn to really dwell in the present moment because death brings that sense that we don't know if we've got another moment. This is the only moment we can be sure about. So what are we doing with this moment? Are we making peace, being kind, being gentle, or are we still trying to get something in the future, you know, trying to strive? So when I say it rouses a sense of spiritual urgency, it means a kind of urgency to develop wholesome states. And there's a very lovely little teaching from the Buddha, which I'll read out to you, about the benefits of death contemplation. So the Buddha says to his monastics, "Monastics, mindfulness of death, when developed and cultivated, is of great fruit and benefit. Here, when the day has receded and night has approached, a person reflects thus, 'I could die on account of many causes, such as snake bite, falling,'" don't say into a waterfall, "'food poisoning,'" hopefully not at Venabu, but who knows, "'or disturbance of,'" it says here, "'bile, phlegm, or wind.'" It basically means the elements of air, fire, and kind of earth when they're out of balance in the body. So basically bodily imbalances that are caused due to this disease or that. "One should reflect thus, do I have any bad, unwholesome qualities that have not been abandoned, which might be an obstacle for me if I were to die tonight? Do I have any bad, unwholesome qualities, or let's say unskillful, or qualities that cause me to suffer, that have not been abandoned, which might be an obstacle for me if I were to die tonight? If one sees one has such qualities, then one should put forth extraordinary aspiration." It says desire, but I know the word is chanda. It's not the word for sensual desire. Not my name, but another kind of chanda, which means a kind of aspiration for the goal. "Effort, zeal, enthusiasm, indefatigability," which is hard to say even in my own language, basically tirelessness, "mindfulness and clear comprehension to abandon those unwholesome qualities." Okay, so we're talking about, again, the aspiration to let go, not the aspiration to attain. The aspiration here to abandon, which is part of letting go. Yeah? So letting go of whatever doesn't serve us, whatever is just causing baggage, it's weighing us down, our delusions, our petty little grudges and attachments, you know, all the trivial stuff that goes around our head that really doesn't deserve to be there. It doesn't deserve that much importance or that much of your time, right? So when we think about death and put our lives in perspective of death, does it really make sense to harbour any grudge? Does it really make sense to have craving? Because even that craving, even if you get the object of your craving, it's going to pass. And that includes the spiritual goals as well. You know, even deep states of meditation like the jhanas are impermanent. And that's one of the insights that can arise on emergence from those states, that they too pass, they too are conditioned. So can we find a little bit more peace and happiness right now? So we can't, you know, trick ourselves at the time of death. The Buddha talks about the importance of having a good death. And it's important to ask ourselves, you know, are we ready to die? And if not, you know, can we practice a bit of letting go now so that at the time of death, we're able to let go of those things we're attached to? And there's a funny story that Ajahn Brahm tells that I have to include because I really like this one. And you've probably, many of you heard it before, but there's this businessman and he's very attached to his business. He's so attached to making lots of money and, you know, really concerned that at the time of death, he's going to have to let that go. But he also recognizes that he's very attached to his kids. And he has so many different attachments, you know, he doesn't really know where to start. But he knows, he's heard the teachings of the Buddha. And the Buddha says, when you're dying, have positive thoughts, have wholesome thoughts. So he thinks, okay, at the time of my death, I need to remember the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, the triple gem. Because he hasn't meditated, he hasn't thought that it's important enough. So he wants a shortcut. So he thinks, right, at the time of my death, I just need to remember the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, and then my mind will be peaceful, I'll be ready to die. But he realizes he hasn't even got full faith in them either. So he comes up with this really clever idea and decides to call his kids, who are going to be there at the time of his death. He renames them Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. Because if his kids are there at the time of his death and he looks at them, then he'll remember Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. Right? Makes a lot of sense. So this is what he does, and his kids obviously are very sort of understanding and agree to have their names changed. And so at the time of his death, he's lying in the bed in the hospital, and lo and behold, his three kids are there. He's so happy. So his kids are there. He opens his eyes between bouts of pain. Oh, okay. Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. Oh, such good children. Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. And then suddenly he thinks, hang on a minute. If all my kids are here at my bedside, who's looking after my business? And then he dies. So it didn't work. He tried to trick the laws of nature. He tried to trick himself into thinking he could let go, but there are no shortcuts. So this is what happens if we haven't practiced letting go in our lifetime. How are we going to do it at the time of death? And in a sense, this is the whole purpose of what we're doing here. You know, of course, it's to have a good life as well. And the contemplation of death helps put a perspective on, you know, what we're doing in our life, what really matters to us, what our priorities are, what our values are. I was reading recently about values, which I find a really fascinating aspect of life and of the mind. And we have certain values in our life that are kind of temporary. For example, we might really value hard work. We value putting in a lot of effort to do well in our job or, you know, to be a good partner, something like this. This is a kind of ordinary human value, which is a positive one. But there are also values called terminal values. And these are even more important. They're not so temporary. They're the kind of values that are going to matter on your deathbed. Terminal values such as how kind have I been? How much gratitude have I showed? How much have I developed wisdom in my life? Yeah, these are kind of the things that really matter when it comes time to let go of this body. So one of the problems, of course, with death contemplation is that we live in very death-averse cultures. You know, the modern societies that we live in, I don't know if they're really modern, but so-called developed industrialized societies, actually hide death from our eyes all the time. And when I first traveled to India, it was a culture shock, totally, because you could see the realities of suffering, impermanence and death all around you. I remember little things, just the first time I saw somebody have a wash outdoors in a bucket, standing in the bucket and covered in soap suds. And I was like, wow, I don't think I've ever had a wash before. Because life literally happens in front of your eyes. It was amazing to me that all this was going on at once, at the same time as kind of cows walking down the street and rickshaws kind of dodging people and a lot of, you know, sickness and death. You would see people with leprosy on the streets begging with, you know, their limbs kind of rotting away. And it was confronting, but it also was, in a sense, somewhat of a reassuring relief. I don't know if that's just me being subversive, but it was a relief to see that this is actually life being honest to itself. And coming back to England, which I did every year and a half or so just to visit my family, was more of a shock once I'd lived in India for several years. It used to be much more of a shock to come back and see that everything was so sterile. It's like, where are the people? Where are the old people, the sick people, the people with dementia? They're all behind the walls of nursing homes. I remember working in a nursing home and I used to think there should be a camera on the wall. There were like 40 people, adults with end-stage Alzheimer's, who didn't have any control over their bodily functions anymore. They didn't really have language, a lot of them anymore. And, you know, there were hardly any people to support them in there. There was hardly any facilities, any kind of, just basic care. You were supposed to lift with two people, but there were never two people to lift a really heavy old lady, you know, from the wheelchair onto the bed or onto the toilet. It was really quite shocking to me. And this is because we try to hide death and dying and sickness from one another, you know, and we don't have those extended families anymore. So there's something about being connected to the reality of death which gives us more resilience when the time comes to die. It removes the shock factor. How many times have you heard somebody say, oh gosh, I'm so distraught. You know, my relative has cancer and maybe they'll die. And you say, oh gosh, I'm so sorry, you know. How old's your relative? 95. They might die. It's like, yeah, they've done pretty well to live to 95, right? But you're going to have to let go at some point. We're going to have to die of something. And it's when we haven't contemplated this that it really is a shock. This happened to the Buddha as well. So it's not that, you know, this is something unique to us. It's not that there's something wrong with us. But even the Buddha, when he was still a young prince, had a very sheltered life, and his father intentionally tried to keep away the realities of sickness and death and old age from him by basically not allowing anyone in the palace or near to his son who was old or sick. And it sounds like an impossible feat, but eventually the Buddha-to-be must have realized something was up, and he decided to leave the palace and go outside in search of a path to liberation. And the first thing that confronted him was a sick person, an old person, and a dead person, but also a renunciate, a wanderer, a samana. They call them samanas in those days, a homeless person who'd gone on search of a spiritual path. And so he saw this and realized, gosh, I'm going to die. I'm going to get sick. Why has nobody told me about this? And it was such a shock for him that it stimulated in him this desire to seek the path. And of course, seeing that renunciate as well showed him that perhaps there's a way beyond. And this was his big quest throughout his life. It wasn't first and foremost to find peace in this life. It was actually to overcome the cycle of birth and death. Because he realized that this is just going on and on and on through countless existences. And whenever is there going to be an end of this? So this really stimulated the Buddha's search. And there's another lovely little passage that I have here. And this is from the Arya Pariyasana Sutta. It's the Majjhima Nikaya number 26, for anyone who wants to jot it down. We usually just put MN26. And it is the two types of search. So this is the kind of thought that arose to the Buddha. He realized, why, when I myself am subject to birth, aging, sickness and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair, do I seek what is also subject to these things, what is also subject to birth, aging, sickness and death? Suppose that instead, being myself subject to these things, having understood the danger in these things, that means the suffering, I seek the end of birth, aging, sickness, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. The undefiled supreme security from bondage, Nibbana. And Nibbana is often dubbed as the deathless. Or let's say, because it's not actually a state of mind as such, it's more the cessation of suffering. Let's say it's the end of dying, it's the end of birth and dying and everything in between. And then further he said, he thought to himself, what is subject to death? Partners, children, I think I've changed the translation a bit here because it says slaves, helpers, colleagues, anagarikas, aspirants, trainees, retreatants, animals, pets, I changed that as well, rather than livestock. But you can have livestock, wealth, transport, etc., subject to death. One who is tied, infatuated, utterly committed to them, being oneself subject to death, seeks what is also subject to death. So we're actually utterly committed to things that are going to die. Can you see the problem there? It's not that we can't have love and care and concern for one another, but if we think that that is going to be, you know, a source of lasting happiness for us, then we're going to really suffer when these things pass away. So as well as this, as well as the kind of potential loss There's also the beautiful aspect of death contemplation, which brings more care and love and concern and empathy into our lives. You know, if you knew, if you really knew that your partner or your parent or child was going to get sick and die, and you might not have much time with them left, how would that change your relationship? How would that change the way you treat them when you're with them? How would it change the care with which you say goodbye? You know, if you're in a hurry in the morning going to work and you just, instead of kind of saying goodbye in a beautiful way, you just kind of snap at your partner and that day they die. I mean, it's not that you should feel guilty. This happens. They know that you love them. But still, what if we could say goodbye to our friends, our partners, maybe our teachers, as though we might not ever see them again? Because one day that will be the case. So why don't we make that now? You know, if we treated everybody as if they are very fragile, you know, this is impermanence in a big way, in a major way, right? Part of the first noble truth is that there is suffering and suffering is to be understood, but a part of the definition of suffering is birth is suffering, death is suffering, just these basic facts. And this kind of suffering is the existential type. There are other kinds of suffering that we can call sort of psychological or, I guess, psychological suffering. You know, it's what we add on to the things in the world, right? Say, not getting what we want. Well, if we adjust our expectations, we can reduce that suffering, or we can make peace, we can be content. But the kind of suffering that's based on death and dying is the existential kind that we can't really bargain with. Right? We're going to have to face it. And so there it's about how we live our lives, you know, so that we have no regrets. So being ourselves subject to dying, understanding everybody else is too, that we're fragile, brings more care. You know, it's like if you had a glass and somebody said, oh, well, this glass is going to break someday. So you said, okay, who cares? I'm just going to throw it on the ground and let it crack. It's going to crack anyway. Just throw it away. Life is, you know, not really worth looking after. That would be a crazy attitude, right? If you know that a glass can break, then you take care of that glass even more. You hold it carefully. I have a cup that I really like to use when I'm on Rain's retreat. It lives in Perth. But one of the bikinis gave it to me before she took full ordination, before she actually trained as an anagarika. So it's very special to me. And it's a sort of sunshine yellow. And every time that I leave Perth, I wrap it in bubble wrap and I just keep it really carefully. Of course, I know it's going to die. It's going to break, right? But that doesn't mean I don't care for it, because it brings up wholesome qualities in me. It brings up a sense of gratitude and appreciation for that person, and a sense of rejoicing in the fact they're living the life of a bhikkhuni now. And yeah, that's probably the only gift they'll ever give me, because now they don't use money at all. So we care more for each other, not less. So what are some of the benefits of death contemplation? And it's not only that gradual contemplation leads to more acceptance, less shock, more an ability to live in line with the laws of nature, with the fact of impermanence, with the fact of change. But it can actually bring a lot more gratitude and love into our lives. It can be a really beautiful practice to realize that this could be our last breath. There's a sutta in the, I forget exactly where the Buddha asks some of his monastics how they practice mindfulness of death. And some of them say, well, I think that, you know, at the end of the day, this could be my last day, you know, and I could die tonight. And he says, well, okay. That is a kind of mindfulness of death. But then he asks the next person and they do a little bit better and say, oh, well, you know, I reflect that I could die, I don't know, in the next few hours. Okay. One of them says, I reflect that this could be my last meal. Yeah, that's a kind of mindfulness of death. But then the next two really get the nail on the head and they say, well, I reflect that this could be my last morsel. This could be the last mouthful that I eat. Did any of you do that this morning at breakfast? It's okay. Nor did I, except when I remembered that quote and I'm like, oh yeah. And then the next one said, well, I reflect that this could be my last breath. Isn't that wonderful? This could be my last breath. How would that change breath meditation? Would you be thinking about the next breath or the previous breath? Maybe you could finally be fully present with this breath, even this part of this breath. So can you see how this brings us closer and closer to the present moment when we reflect in this way? And with gratitude, if this really was your last breath, how would you want to breathe it? Would you want to like fight with it or control it or kind of drag it into your mind? Or would you rather want to just really hang out with it, really chill, just really surf that breath? Just see how much contentment can be there in a single breath. So this is one of the really beautiful ways to practice death contemplation. There's another way in the suttas that monastics are supposed to reflect on every day, and maybe some of these phrases can be helpful for you as well. One of the things that we say is, I am of the nature to die. I have not gone beyond dying. And that can extend to, I am of the nature to be sick. I have not gone beyond sickness. I am of the nature to age. I have not gone beyond aging. Is that true? Do we look in the mirror and think, oh, I'm still not too old. I can still see some youth in my face. Or are we honest, you know, and say, okay, there's some wrinkles appearing here. Am I going to run out to the shop and buy all this fake cream that doesn't work at all and charges a fortune? Or am I just going to understand that, yes, the body is decaying, the body is dying, and you know, I've lived a good life so far, but how do I want to be spending the rest of my life? Maybe it's a little bit too difficult to think this is my last breath or this is my last mouthful. But what if you just had 3 months? What if you just had 3 months or 6 months? It happens. I have a friend in Perth and she was such a skilled practitioner and psychotherapist as well. She'd been giving a lot of support to the Sangha over there, especially Bodhinyana and Jhana Grove, and practicing for at least 40-odd years. And she was in great health. I spoke to her while she was in Thailand and she was enjoying her time. She was there for her son's temporary ordination because she's married to a Thai person, and I think they had a... I'm not sure if it was a genetic son or stepson. And she looked so happy. She always wore a lot of bright colours. And she said, oh, yeah, it's just I've got a little bit of sort of ache in the chest. I think it's the COVID that I've just had. You know, I'm still a little bit tired. I've got a bit of a sort of soreness in my chest. And then she got back to Perth and went to the doctor. And they said, we don't think it's the COVID, actually. You've got terminal bowel cancer, stage 4, and it's a very aggressive kind. And she just couldn't have ever envisaged that because this pain was in her chest, not in her bowel. But it was so advanced that she was basically told, you've got sort of 3 or 4 months to live. And I remember the first time I met her and she said to me, I've got cancer, and she looked quite distressed and we spoke and she was having a lot of tears. And yeah, no, you've practiced a long time, but still it's hard to face that kind of news, right, when it's just a few months left. She was planning with her husband to go back to Thailand and retire there. And she had plans. We all have plans, don't we, you know, about what's going to happen in the future to make our life even better. But I was very privileged to be able to accompany her to some extent in the last few months of her life. And this involved me going to see her in the hospice where she was, in a place called Kalamondo, which is very beautiful in the hills. And it was just extraordinary going to visit her because she would talk in such detail about the processes that were happening in her mind. I mean, maybe being a really exceptional psychodynamic psychotherapy, which is, I guess, you really get to know the inner workings of your mind, being a Buddhist practitioner as well. And just the clarity and the fascination when she was seeing the various states of mind coming and going. And she would go through periods of fear, but she'd also go through what she called, she had this perception coming up more and more, almost like an intuition of leaving her body, because she didn't rate her meditation that highly. She didn't think she got that deep so far. But when it came close to her time of dying, she actually started getting this intuition that there's this whole other realm, like this mental realm full of peace and bliss. And she called it like the room of delights. So her mind would kind of start leaving the material world and going into this room of delights where she felt so peaceful and so loved and so full of delight. And she said there was a door in this room and it was kind of beckoning her through, but she wasn't quite ready to go through. And I told Ajahn Brahm about that and he told me, next time you go and see her, tell her to walk through that door. And we used to speak, you know, when I went to visit her, and she used to get quite eager and excited about what lay ahead, about the process, you know. And she said to me at the end of one conversation, it'll be a shame, won't it, after all of this, if I don't die. It was so sweet. It was so sweet. Yeah. Because, of course, there's some fear there, but it's a journey. It's this really incredible journey where your practice starts to bear fruit. And in the Buddhist tradition, we say, you know, that the moment of death can be a moment of awakening. Somebody asked a couple of days ago about what happens to the stream winners. Do they kind of have a moment of awakening, full liberation at the time of death? Quite possibly. Also, for someone who's practiced a lot of jhanas, well, especially if you're a stream winner, you can go straight to the non-returning state if you die in a jhana, according to Ajahn Brahm and according to a particular passage in the suttas. But I think even for people who, you know, have practiced deeply in this life or practiced to the best of their ability, at the time of death, if you haven't already experienced a nimitta, for example, that is your opportunity, because that's when you actually let go of the body. You know, if you've practiced even the idea of letting go of the body and got a sense of how beautiful that can be when the body processes calm down, parts of the body start to disappear, maybe the body becomes very expansive, it's barely physical form anymore, and you enter the realm of the mind, then at the time of death, this is what happens. And so often people talk about going into the light. That's just going into the nimitta. If you can enter that nimitta, then you go into the jhana realm, so you're likely to get an incredibly good rebirth. And if you have wisdom as well, who knows, maybe that's the moment of stream winning. If you're already on the path, then it can happen. It has to happen in this life, either before you die or at the time of death. So if you've been cultivating the path, there's nothing to fear. There's nothing to be afraid of. It's actually an opportunity for your practice to really get catalyzed in a sense. So I am of the nature to die, I've not gone beyond dying, is a really important reflection. Another one is, the days and the nights are relentlessly passing. How well am I spending my time? Again, how would you spend your time differently if you only had a few months left? Or let's say a few years. I had a melanoma diagnosed on my arm. It's my tough forest nun arm. I really like it. It's like this wicked scar. Just a little melanoma and they give you a massive scar. It looks like you're really hardcore. Anyway, I'm very lucky because they caught it early. But at the time that they found it, I looked online, of course, what's the prognosis? And if it had spread, then I would have only had up to 5 years. I think 20% chance actually of living for 5 years or something like that. And I was like, whoa, okay, I don't feel like I'm going to die. I don't feel like it's my time, but this is real. And I have no idea if it spread, because it was actually changing for a couple of years. I had this huge, weird looking mole for years and it had been growing and developing. So I thought, okay. And two things I noticed, which were quite amazing. One was that I would go about my day just normally, just forgetting that I'm subject to death. And then without even thinking about it, this visceral sense of ooh would just take me over, like sort of a tremor through the body, like suddenly realizing, hang on, you could die. And that's the case always, right? But it took having something on my arm that was visible to bring that home. And that was really interesting. But the other thing that was amazing was that the people around me, I felt so much love for them. I just felt this overflowing of love. and gratitude and connection somehow, which was very, very beautiful. And my friend in Perth said the same. She said that whenever a nurse or a visitor or anyone who was working in that hospital would come through her door, she'd just have this overwhelming sense of gratitude and love. And she said to me, why is that happening? I'm not trying to do that. I'm not practicing deeply or anything like that. I said, well, it's the practice of your life. It's the cultivation of wholesome states throughout your life that is now coming to the fore. And I had the same experience, this sense of real love. But the other really interesting thing was that I asked myself at that time, okay, if I've only got, say, 3 years, how would I change my life? And until then, I probably had some, definitely sometimes had some negativity towards my situation, being away from Sangha, not having anywhere to stay, working really, really hard, you know, feeling pretty isolated as a bhikkhuni in England, the only one, and not having any spiritual friends because I hadn't lived in England throughout my adult life, basically. I left when I was 19, and here I was at kind of 40, back in England with nothing and trying to do the impossible, you know, with very little support. And I was very, very tired, you know, constantly kind of organizing retreats and trying to live. I mean, you try and live without money, without cooking, without being able to drive around, without other people there to help you. It's very hard. And so sometimes I felt like, what am I doing? You know, before my meditation was much deeper, I'm losing my momentum and, you know, maybe I should be going back to a kuti somewhere and get back on track. But when I had this melanoma and I thought, okay, what if I only had 3 more years? I realized how much I really believe in what I'm doing and how passionate I am about it. And even though perhaps I would do it with a little bit less stress if I only had 3 years, because, you know, there's only so much you can do, right, in 3 years' time, I wouldn't actually change a thing. And that really surprised me. And I think, I mean, it's not necessarily the case for everybody that you're doing what you really want to be doing, but I think what it did was make me realize how much I value what I'm doing and the opportunity and how kind of unnecessary and it spoils things, really, to complain too much. You know, we can easily complain about the things that are wrong, but how often do we really look at what's right? So I guess that's the terminal values thing again. You know, what really matters in the light of death? And what mattered to me is, yes, meditation. Maybe I would be able to do more practice. Maybe I would, you know, be able to go about my work with less stress, less urgency. But at the same time, I wouldn't give it up. You know, I would make sure that the project was in a good place so somebody else could take over because I believe in it and it has a lot of meaning for me. So it's very interesting when we can contemplate in this way. And hopefully it doesn't have to be like the threat of a terminal disease. By the way, I'm fine because it hadn't spread for now, right? I'm fine for now, but there's all kinds of other sicknesses there. So it really puts things in perspective and makes you value your life, really value your life. You know, it doesn't really matter how far you get along with something either, or just the fact that you tried, the fact that you gave it your best. Same in meditation. It doesn't matter so much how far you go. It's more, you know, that you're doing what you can with the conditions that you have. And conditions change all the time. I know there's people in this room that are worked to the bone, have a lot of stress in their life, don't have as much meditation time as they wish they did, myself included. This is actually more meditation here than I usually get to do. So, but that is causes and conditions out of your hands. That has nothing to do with your motivation or your inner qualities. In fact, if anything, if it's right livelihood, you're just building the foundation much stronger. So when you do have a conditions to practice, the results and the depth of your practice, results is the wrong word, but the integrity or the when it's integrated, your practice will be integrated. It will have a solid foundation on which you can build. So we can't necessarily control the conditions, but we can do the best with what we have and really reflect on the fact that that's what you're doing and feel some happiness about that. And another one is, all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. Again, it goes back to this appreciation of the people we have in our lives. Since I met Ajahn Brahm actually in 2010, I've been thinking he's about to drop dead. Sorry, Ajahn. He knows. I tell him. But by now I've given up really worrying about it. I actually really worried about it for the first few years. I used to be able to make myself cry quite easily when I saw what he ate. And at some point about 4 or 5 years ago, I was just like, there's nothing I can do. He's the stubbornest person in the world, apart from me, of course. and he's not going to change. So, you know, you just have to accept it. And I guess, in a sense, that's brought more appreciation of the fact that he is here now, because I've been thinking for 15 years that he's going to die. I'm sure it'll still be very difficult when he does, but I certainly don't take it for granted while he's alive. So, yeah. That's a good thing, you know. Not that you want to be thinking about this all the time. This is one of four protections. Another one is metta. Another one is, you know, this unattractiveness of the body. And the other one is remembering the Buddha, right? Or the Dhamma or the Sangha. And there's many other types of beautiful meditations. But sometimes death meditation is very good. You can also do it in your walking meditation. I did this in Perth when I was on a so-called 6 months retreat, which got kind of sabotaged after 4 months. But anyway, I had 4 months of solitary meditation in the retreat kuti, you know, the retreat kuti, which is really beautiful. It has its own valley and its own stream and everything. It's just stunning. And I was doing the, sometimes, you know, it's nice to do the single breath meditation, but I was doing the one step meditation. And I just imagined while I was doing the walking meditation that this is my last step. Wow, the mindfulness in that step was amazing. You know, really appreciating the fact that I can move my foot, I can put it down, I can feel the sensations in my heel, and then the weight shifting onto the next part of the foot. And honestly, bliss was in my feet. Like, I was just getting so much bliss with each step, because it was like, if you really imagine this is your last step, it's like, whoa, it's coming to the end. And it's really, you get a lot of energy coming up. So anyway, don't do it for the bliss. And it doesn't always work. I don't know if I've had that again since, but it was a really beautiful practice. You can also use a kind of little mantra if you want, which I don't know. I haven't really tried. One of Ajahn Brahm's suggestions that he got from another monk is to do your walking meditation. One step, I will die. Next step, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. Another friend of mine who's at Bodhinyana says that he does it like, I'm dying, I'm dying, which is even more present, right? It's even more immediate. It's like, not I will die, but I'm dying, I'm dying. They sound a bit, maybe a bit dark to some of you. I like the idea of life is uncertain, death is certain. Life is uncertain, death is certain. That's quite nice. But I actually thought that you could turn that around and say life is certain, death is uncertain. Because actually we're alive now and we don't know when death's coming. Anyway, I don't want to confuse you, but you can play. That's the idea. You can play. You can play around. So I also wanted to talk about, okay, the last 50 minutes can be all about bliss. Is that good? Because I wanted to talk about near-death experiences and how we can help other people lose their fear of death. Because when we practice death contemplation, we can then be a support for others. Of course, first we have to face our own fear around death and also around losing people, right? So that we can be of genuine support. So we have to do our emotional work first. And then it's easier to let the people that we love go. A lot of the reason that we can't let people go is because, not because we're worried about them, but because we're worried about how we'll manage without them, right? Sometimes we don't know how we'll cope. So we have to, you know, try to embrace our own fear, our own grief around that, and then we can be of support to others in a really unconditional way. And also to see serving others in their later life or dying moments as an opportunity to serve. In the Buddha's day, there was a very sick monk who had boils all over his body. They're supposed to be really enormous, like they just grew and grew and grew and were full of pus and it, ugh. And even the other monks were disgusted by this and they just left him alone and he was soiled and just sick on the floor of this hut. And when the Buddha came to know about this, he was quite shocked. And he went to tend to this monk himself with, you know, medicine and warm water and salt or whatever he put on the wounds. And he washed him himself, which is beautiful. It's a beautiful image, isn't it, of the Buddha, who is, you know, the most respectworthy, great being probably in the history of anybody, anywhere. And, you know, somebody that we can revere and look up to, humbling themselves. Because, of course, a wise person is also a deeply compassionate person. So the Buddha was there doing the work. And at the end of that, he said to the monks, it was his way of admonishing them, he said, "One who serves the sick serves me. One who serves the sick serves the Buddha." So this is some of the best karma we can possibly do, serving the Buddha directly by serving the sick. You don't have to be there hands-on, but you can give donations maybe to the Gaza crisis or, you know, whatever, to the earthquake relief in Myanmar. You know, we can serve people who are vulnerable, who are struggling, who are dying, who are in the need of help. And by doing that, we're serving the Buddha, especially when we're serving those that other people would shun. Another really important thing when people are dying is to give them the confidence to die. So again, this is looking at the positive aspects of their life and the things that they can really rejoice in. So it's not all about the last mind moment. This is a myth found in the Abhidhamma teachings. It's actually what determines your death, you know, whether you have a good death and a good rebirth, is the general quality of your life. How have you been living so far? What is the general direction of your life? And if you've done a lot of goodness, get them to remember it. Remember it for yourself when you're coming to that point, but if you're supporting someone else who's, you know, dying, talk to them about all the wonderful things they've done. Maybe the things that you're grateful for, you know, the ways that they've supported you, the qualities that you see in them. Maybe some of the remarkable things they've done or the things that made them happy in their life. I heard about one man who wrote a book all about the things he was grateful for and the things that he'd done that were really good each day. And at the time of his dying, he had it read out to him. You know, on this day, this happened to you, and this is what you did, and this is how a person thanked you, or whatever kindness was there. And this uplifts the mind, so it makes the person feel really happy about their life, so they can die peacefully. I also heard of somebody, and I think in Perth, who decided to have his funeral while he was alive. Partly to hear his own eulogy. He wanted to hear what people would say about him, because we don't give each other enough praise, right? I mean, that's something I actively do all the time in the monastery. I always try and point out people's qualities, also because I see them and it makes me very happy to see them. It's kind of a counter to feeling stressed. When I look around me and I see all the wonderful people I'm with, it just uplifts me and brings me a lot of joy, and that helps me to deal with my workload. So we can do that for one another, but we can also, you know, receive that ourselves. So he wanted to hear his eulogy before he died. He also wanted to see who would come to the funeral so he could put the right people in his will, which is a bit cheeky, isn't it? But anyway, we can do that for each other. We can bring up those things, you know, that make us happy and tell each other, even now, you know, what we're grateful for. And yeah, again, it's important to help remove a person's fears by explaining to them that it's not all about the last mind moment, and it's also not a negative thing to die. It's not because of your bad karma that you're sick. It's not because of your bad karma that you die young. People die at any age. You know, in the Buddha's day, people died. Like, there were women who lost all their children and family members, like, in a single day. And it was common. You know, one of the great disciples of the Buddha, Patachara, she became foremost in the training, in the monastic training, and she was an incredible teacher. She lost her two babies, her husband and her parents and brother, all in 24 hours. And she was completely grief-stricken. Can you imagine? It's just impossible to imagine. She went naked, running through the streets, completely out of her mind. And the Buddha saw her and said, come, and talked to her about the Dhamma, gave her some robes to wear. And then she became called Patachara, which means the robe wearer or the rag wearer, something like this. And as a result of the tragedies she went through, she had all these disciples. And I read about this recently in the Therigata. There, many of them were other nuns who hadn't had much success in their meditation. But when they came to her, suddenly she was such a great teacher that they were all getting, you know, lots of success. Like, they were breaking through to stream winning and full liberation under her guidance. And a lot of these women had also lost children. So it made me wonder, is it her empathy, you know, the fact that she knew, she understood, that could make her such a powerful source of support for these others? So this happened a lot in those days. And it's not because, you know, of bad karma that somebody dies young. The Buddha said that, you know, birth is the cause of death. So if you want to say it's bad karma, then bad karma for being born. Right? So we have to remove these fears and this stigma when someone's about to die. And lastly, to talk to them about what can happen, you know, in the dying process. And there's a lovely book, which I'll write down for you after this, called After. It's not called After Death because that makes it sound like there's too much belief involved. But this is a book about near-death experiences. And there are so many stories recorded there. I just jotted down a few points. And they really show us that, you know, people who've had any kind of life can still experience bliss at the time of death. Some of the people in this book were like mafia people or people that weren't very nice at all in their life. And at the time of death, they went into complete bliss states and came back completely changed. It influenced their life from then on in an incredibly positive way. And this mafia guy actually lost his girlfriend, who was a bit disappointed that he didn't want to make lots of money and do lots of bad things anymore. Instead, he became a social worker or something like that. So this is the power, right, of these experiences to transform our lives. And it gives you a taste of what can happen at death and also after death. So there was one experience of a boy who drowned, and these people are pronounced clinically dead at the scene, right? So they actually die at that time, and their mind leaves the body. The mind is not the same as the brain. And his way of describing it was that the mind expands without the limit of the brain, and things seem more real than ever before. I'm sure that if you've got anywhere close to deep meditation, or however much stillness you've got, you've realized that you can somehow get in touch with the mind that's bigger, bigger than the brain. It's beyond thinking, first of all, right? And then it seems to expand, and that's why you start having strange experiences, like Bhantanita was saying about, you know, having many different experiences along the way towards deep meditation. Your mind, I think Ajahn Brahm's phrase is, perception takes wings. Your perception takes wings because it's outside of the usual kind of constructs and kind of rules that we put around us. So he said also that one minute he was terrified and the next minute he became the calm one watching. Also reminds me of meditation, where one minute you can be, for example, you can have anxiety or something. The next moment, with a change of attitude, the mind becomes big. You stand back and you're just the observer, completely calm. Another woman was hit on the head. She was, a lot of these are quite sort of sudden accidents, actually, and maybe that's one of the things that makes it so vivid in people's memory. But this woman was a diver, and she was diving off a board into a pool, and she did some kind of backflip and hit the back of her head on the board. And she said she went into this timeless place where she was loved and things made profound sense. That aspect of love and wisdom together. It was a warm, comfortable, peaceful silence with love surrounding everything and within. So interesting for me reading these descriptions because they really describe some of the states of meditation. Free from the usual limits of consciousness and thought. So again, that idea of being freed from, you know, the restrictions that the brain puts upon us. And it's interesting in this book, my favourite chapter actually, apart from these stories, was a chapter about the difference between the mind and the brain. And this is a doctor who's written it and done a lot of studies and research, and many scientists agree at this point that far from the old-fashioned understanding of the mind being a product of the brain, it's more the case that the mind is filtered through the brain, and the brain filters the vast potential of the mind so that it's concerned only with keeping these five senses or these five khandhas alive. So we basically shut out most of the other information, stuff like invisible beings or, you know, the kind of stuff that can start to happen actually when you move beyond the limits of the brain. So this is really fascinating, and it transformed people's lives. It transformed people's attitudes to death. They had less anxiety. They were more likely to lend a helping hand. They were more compassionate, more resilient. So sometimes, you know, this is obviously a benefit that can come to you if you get into these meditations in this life. But it's something to look forward to at the time of death as well. You know, and the more we practice letting go, the more we practice meeting every situation with a lot of tenderness and care, you know, with that sense that we don't know how long these conditions will last. We don't know how long we have to practice. We don't know how long we have a human body that's going to be able to sit in meditation or lie down in meditation. The more we recognize this, the more alert and alive we become to this present moment, and we can really develop deep contentment and appreciation for our lives, for each moment of our lives. So these are some of the potentials of mindfulness of death. And really, all we have to do is trust the process, keep trusting the process of meditation. You know, it's a conditioned process. Some of these reflections that we've been talking about may help. If they help, great. If they don't help, try something else. These are so many different methods and tools to practice. So just see that it's always leading towards wholesome states. What leads to wholesome states is the best practice for you at any given time. Okay. So there you go. You're still alive.